The reading this morning is from the book of Genesis. Yahweh appeared to Abraham by the oaks of Mamre as he sat at the entrance of his tent in the heat of the day. He looked up and saw three men standing near him. When he saw them, he ran from the tent entrance to them to meet them and bowed down to the ground. He said, "Yahweh, if I find favor with you, do not pass by your servant. Let a little water be brought and wash your feet and rest yourselves under the tree. Let me bring a little bread that you may refresh yourselves and after that you may pass on since you have come to your servant." So they said, "Do as you have said." And Abraham hastened into the tent to Sarah and said, "Make ready quickly 3 measures of choice flour, knead it, and make cakes." Abraham ran to the herd and took a calf, tender and good, and gave it to the servant, who hastened to prepare it. Then he took curds and milk and the calf that he had prepared and set it before them, and he stood by them under the tree while they ate. Hear what the Spirit is saying to the church.
Thanks be to God.
The Holy Gospel of our Lord Jesus Christ according to John. Jesus showed himself again to the disciples by the Sea of Tiberias, and he showed himself in this way. Gathered together were Simon Peter, Thomas called the Twin, Nathanael of Cana in Galilee, the sons of Zebedee, and 2 others of his disciples. Simon Peter said to them, "I'm going fishing." They said to him, "We will go with you." They went out and got into the boat, but that night they caught nothing. Jesus, after daybreak, Jesus stood on the beach, but the disciples did not know that it was Jesus. Jesus said to them, "Children, you have no fish, have you?" They answered him, "No." He said to them, "Cast the net to the right side of the boat, and you will find some." So they cast it, and now they were not able to haul it in because there were so many fish. That disciple whom Jesus loved said to Peter, "It is Yahweh." When Simon Peter heard that it was Yahweh, he put on some clothes, for he was naked, and jumped into the sea. But the other disciples came in the boat, dragging the net full of fish, but they were not far from the land, only about 100 yards off. When he had gone ashore, they saw a charcoal fire there with fish on it, with bread. Jesus said to them, "Bring some of the fish that you have caught." So Simon Peter went aboard and hauled the net ashore, full of large fish, 153 of them, and though they were so many, the net was not torn. Jesus said to them, "Come and have breakfast." Now none of the disciples dared to ask him, "Who are you?" because they knew it was Yahweh. Jesus came and took the bread and gave it to them and did the same with the fish. There was now the 3rd time that Jesus appeared to the disciples after he was raised from the dead. The Gospel of Christ.
I need to begin with just a little bit of a clarification, and I kind of hate to do this because, Jeff, it's going to look like I'm putting you on the spot, and that's not what I'm trying to do. Okay, no problem. No problem. In the Hebrew Bible, in the Old Testament, in our English Bibles, we often see the words "the Lord" in small caps. And when we see that in the Hebrew Bible, what that means is it's the covenant name of the God of Israel behind that, which the most educated guess to say it is Yahweh. And so the name Yahweh will only ever show up in the Hebrew Bible. In the New Testament, which was written in Greek, that doesn't happen. And our readers, I give them instructions when I want to make sure that we say Yahweh when it should be Yahweh, and they read, they see the Lord on the book, and then they remember, oh yeah, it's supposed to be Yahweh, and that's exactly what Jeff did for the Old Testament reading. But then he did it for the New Testament reading too. And I just want to make it clear that when they were in the boat and they saw Jesus, they didn't say it is Yahweh. In this case, they would have literally said it is the Lord, because they would refer to Jesus as their Lord, as their master. Sometimes it's used as a way of saying sir, you know, that kind of thing. So just to clarify, and again, I appreciate all of our readers who make that edit on the fly. And Jeff, I commend you for holding on to that, but that'll never happen in the New Testament, right? Yeah, that's all good. It's all good. Anybody has a problem with that? Volunteer to read the scriptures, okay? So for the sermon itself, let me begin simply by saying that we now come to John 21, which is kind of an odd chapter in the Gospel of John, because you don't really need it, dare I say. Last week, we finished up with John chapter 20. That's where Mary Magdalene sees Jesus at the empty tomb. Then we have the 10 apostles that have Jesus visiting them. And then a week later, the 11 apostles, because now Thomas is there with them, have Jesus appear to them again. And Jesus zeroes in on Thomas and says to him, "Do you believe because you have seen? Blessed rather are those who have not seen and yet believe." And then, the author says, Jesus did many other signs in the presence of his disciples, which are not recorded in this book. But these are written that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that by believing you may have life in his name. And it all gets wrapped up with a nice little bow, and that should be the end of the book. Because it's a perfect ending. It's fantastic. But then you turn the page, and there's another chapter. And chapter 21 kind of comes across like it's a bit of an appendix or an addendum, an epilogue, if you will. It doesn't seem all that necessary. And yet, it's different from what I described last week happened with the Gospel of Mark, right? Because the Gospel of Mark, which was written first, only ended with 8 verses, and the women left the tomb, and they didn't say anything to anybody, and that's it. That's how it ends. And then only after Matthew, Luke, and Mark are written does someone later come back to, Matthew, Luke, and John are written, someone comes back to Mark later and adds an episode from John and an episode from Luke and an episode from Matthew to fill out the story of Mark. But that's not what's happening here in the Gospel of John. But nevertheless, the earliest manuscripts we have include chapter 21 in the Gospel, so we take it as part of the package. But what do we do with it? Because it has a couple of interesting episodes. It's kind of like, well, it's one more appearance of Jesus after his resurrection, but it's kind of like two episodes, because we have the first half of the chapter, which is him appearing to 7 of his disciples, and then afterwards he takes Peter aside and has a one-on-one with Peter alone, which could kind of come across as its own thing. We'll get into that one next week. But what do we do with this? It's kind of, like I said, unnecessary for the purpose of what John is writing. But there's got to be a reason for using it, to read it, to contemplate it. And I'm going to suggest this morning that perhaps the best way to read John chapter 1 is to read it devotionally. And what I mean by that is to read this final chapter not so much as being, you know, a necessary part of the story that John was trying to say, but instead an invitation for us to take everything that John has been writing about and personalize it a little bit. Hopefully this sermon will shed light on what I mean. But let's go ahead and revisit what the encounter is that we have. And this is part of the reason, as we explore it, why I'm going to tell you it's not really fully necessary as far as it goes. But let's take a look. We start off with knowing that Jesus showed himself again by the Sea of Tiberias. The Sea of Tiberias, the Lake of Gennesaret, the Sea of Galilee, they're all the same place. I don't know why they have 3 different names, but there it is. So they're up in the Sea of Galilee, which is where everything got started. The disciples have gone back to the beginning, and Jesus is going to appear to them back where he first met them. And it says that Jesus showed himself in this way. And then it goes on to say that there were gathered together 7 apostles, 7 of the disciples, Simon Peter, Thomas the twin, who we just had an episode with in the previous chapter, Nathanael of Cana in Galilee, who we were introduced to at the beginning of the book in chapter 1, and then the sons of Zebedee, which are James and John, and then 2 other disciples who remain unnamed. Later on, we find out that one of those two disciples is the disciple whom Jesus loved, which tradition tells us is the author of the gospel, but we really don't know, leaving ultimately one unidentified disciple, which is really weird. Because in all the Gospels, we get a list of all 12 of the disciples that he called apostles. We have no shortage of names. We even get people named that we don't know anything about, like Bartholomew. I mean, his name shows up, but he doesn't do anything in any of the Gospels, right? Why is this seventh disciple unnamed? And the suggestion is that perhaps what that invites the reader to do, remembering that the readers of the Gospel of John, every one of the readers of the Gospel of John is believing without having seen, right? All the readers of the Gospel of John have never been with Jesus physically. The invitation, perhaps, is for the reader of the Gospel of John to see themselves as that seventh disciple. And the fact that there's seven disciples kind of hints at this a little bit more, perhaps, because there were 11 of the apostles kicking around. Why only seven? Well, again, with the importance of numbers that we see in the Gospel of John, seven signs, seven I am statements, the fact that seven is one of those complete numbers, it's a number that implies divine completion. Seven is a sufficient and full number of disciples. And as you read the gospel, you're one of them. You're part of the team. You're in the story, if you will. And I think that is what John is inviting the reader to do as he tells this story. So after naming these disciples and leaving the wild card disciple out there for the reader to find themselves in there, it says that Peter said, "I'm going fishing." The others said, "We'll come with you." And so off they go to go fishing. Now, most every sermon I've ever heard on this passage takes that statement as being a little bit of a negative kind of thing. That after this fantastic year with Jesus and all the stuff that's been going on, one could say 3 years as you read the Gospel of John, after this time with Jesus where they've seen amazing things, they've done amazing things, they've lived through the horror of the crucifixion, they've had the joy of the resurrection and all of these things, and then in the previous chapter they saw Jesus and all these things, after all of that, because now we don't know how long it's been since they last saw Jesus, it seems like Peter and the disciples found themselves back where they started, and it's like, well, that was fun while it was lasted. I guess we just go back to everyday life. We just go back to what's familiar as if nothing happened. And that's how I've tended to hear this passage preached. I'm going fishing because as far as Peter is concerned, everything's over. But there's no reason to think that that's what's going on here. Peter is a fisherman. And even though you can buy food at markets and stuff like that, how the food gets to the market is by having people, you know, catch the fish so it can be sold. Like, there's no reason to think that he wouldn't continue doing the fishing thing. Like, were we expecting that he would just suddenly hit the road and be an evangelist from here on in? Like, it's not an issue for him to go fishing and for the others to join him, since others were fishermen as well. Although Nathanael of Cana probably wasn't a fisherman, and it's doubtful that Thomas was. See what I did there? Anyway, they're going to go fishing. Peter's going to go fishing. Why not? Let's do it together. Nothing more to read into that except for the fact this is what opens up the episode, because it's what happens next that becomes really important. They fish all night because that's what you do. Fishing at night is better, because I learned this when I started dating Wanda. Her father was a fisherman, and so going up to the Cariboo of British Columbia, I learned how to get into a boat and troll for trout with a fly rod, even though when I was told I was going to get a fly rod, I thought, I did tell you I've never fished before, right? I thought fly fishing is for guys who are good, but we would just drag it. We'd just troll the lines. Anyway, my father-in-law told me that even though it can be really, really pleasant to be on the water in the middle of the day where the sun is warm, the best time to fish is when it's cool. Because as the day gets warmer and the water gets heated up by the sun, the fish swim deeper and it's harder to get them. So when you fish at night, the fish are a lot closer to the surface, and especially if you're fishing with a big old net, you don't want to be dredging the bottom of the lake or the sea anyway, so nighttime is the time to fish. So nothing unusual about that. They fish all night, and they don't catch anything. Does that sound at all familiar? It should. Because in Luke chapter 5, we get the story of what is known as Jesus and the miraculous catch of fish. What happens in Luke 5, now, even though we're talking about the Gospel of John, because Luke was written before John was written, it's not unlikely that John was familiar with the story, and I think that's exactly what he's alluding to here. Jesus is teaching the people, and they're crowding up against him, and he's up against the lake, so he finds two boats, and he gets into one that happens to belong to Simon Peter. He hasn't called any of his disciples yet. And he tells Peter to push out a little ways. And so they go out a little ways, and Jesus can now teach the crowd with a little bit of personal space. Perhaps they can hear him better as the sound bounces across the water. But he teaches the people from the lake. And then, at the end of that, he turns to Simon Peter and says, "Put out into deep water and let your nets down for a catch." And Peter says to him, "We were fishing all night, and we haven't caught anything. But because you say so, we'll go ahead and do that." So now we're seeing this early episode between Jesus and the disciples being bookmarked, or bookended rather, by this story where once again they've fished all night and haven't caught anything. So how this works is it's early in the morning, it's twilight, they're 100 yards from shore, they can't really make out who that is there, but whoever is on the shore, it's Jesus, they just don't know it's Jesus, he calls out to them, "Children, you haven't any fish, have you?" The Living Bible version of the Bible says, "Any fish, boys?" Which doesn't sound quite right, but it is curious that the New Revised Standard Version has him call out, "Children, you haven't any fish, have you?" Is that perhaps just a tender, kind of warm way to address his friends? I don't know. But anyway, he calls out, and they just shout back, "No." And so he says, "Let your nets out on the right side of the boat." Like that should make a difference. But they do. And then they start hauling in so much fish, they can't get it into the boat. Once again, back in Luke chapter 5, when they go out and put their nets down, they end up getting so many fish that both boats start to sink because there's so many fish in the net. But it's interesting, in the Luke chapter 5 episode, we're told that the nets begin to break. We're told in this episode that the nets didn't break. Huh. This is interesting. It's the same, but different. What is going on? What is this narrative trying to tell us? We're revisiting this earlier episode. Well, anyhow, once they get this miraculous catch of fish again, then the disciple whom Jesus loved finally puts two and two together and says to Peter, "It's the Lord." And when Peter heard that it was the Lord, he put on his cloak because he was naked and jumped into the water. Okay, hold on. Let's just back up a little bit here. One of the things to keep in mind when we consider the Bible being written is that whether you're writing on papyrus or parchment, that writing material, including the ink you use to write, is a precious commodity. It's probably just as expensive as printer ink these days, right? Like, that's the most expensive liquid on the planet right now, you know? You don't want to be wasting parchment or papyrus, or ink for that matter, writing something down that doesn't need to be set. If you're going to write it down, it has to mean something. It's got to have a purpose. Okay, so what could this possibly mean? Well, let's start with the fact that Peter was naked. Well, that's not a big deal. Probably all of the disciples in the boat were naked, right? I mean, if you are going fishing and you've got nets and lines and all this stuff and you're dressed like this, it's a lot easier just to get undressed so you got nothing that you're going to get tangled up with. You're going to be working hard. You're going to be sweating. You have to stay cool and all of this. Like, the fact that he was naked would have been pretty normal for doing the fishing thing. You strip down for action, right? So mentioning that he was naked would explain why he put on his cloak, right? Because to say he put on his cloak, well, why would he need to say that? Well, because he was naked. Okay, that's fine. He puts on his cloak. Okay, but why did he put on his cloak? Because then he jumps out of the boat into the water. If you are going to go swimming, you take your clothes off, right? You don't put on more clothes in order to go swimming. You take them off. So what on earth is Peter doing putting on a cloak if his intention is to jump into the water in the first place? I cannot say that this is the reason, but what I like to think is this. Back in Matthew chapter 14, there's a storm on the Sea of Galilee. The disciples are afraid, stormy, and then Jesus comes walking out on the water and then calms the storm and tells Peter, come out and walk on the water to me. And Peter gets out and starts walking on the water. But then, oh, actually, he hasn't calmed the storm yet because he looks at the wind and the waves and he's afraid and he begins to sink and he calls out to Jesus, help me. And Jesus pulls him up and brings him over to the boat, sticks him in the boat and says, oh, you of little faith, why did you doubt? What I like to think is that Peter, at this moment, when he realizes it's Jesus and there's 100 yards of water between him and the shore, he says, I'm going to show him. I can't wait to see him, and I'm going to show him that I've learned, especially since Peter knows he's denied Jesus 3 times already. And he throws his coat on, fully intending to run across the 100 yards of water to get to Jesus. Now, he doesn't do that. He goes kerplunk and he swims instead. But I like to think that his intention, the reason he put the clothes on, was because he wanted to show that he expected to be dry by the time he got to see Jesus. This attempt to try to recover something, to show faithfulness, to show his confidence in his Lord. I don't know if that's true, but that's the way I like to read it. Well, Peter gets to the shore, the rest of the disciples get up to the shore as well, and we find that Jesus is there, and there's a charcoal fire burning on the beach. We'll come back to the charcoal fire next week. But there is fish and bread. And then Jesus tells them to bring some of the fish that they have caught. And so Peter goes back single-handedly to grab the net and bring it in, and they have a meal together. Does that sound at all familiar? I mean, Jesus having a meal with his disciples would have been something that happened a lot, but of course the Last Supper springs to mind. This might be the last Supper, but also the fact that it's fish and bread. All four Gospels record the feeding of the 5,000. In Mark chapter 6, Matthew chapter 14, Luke chapter 9, and John chapter 6, we get the story of the feeding of the 5,000, where 5,000 men plus women and children are fed to their satisfaction by 5 loaves of bread and 2 fish. And here Jesus has bread and fish, and he's feeding his disciples once again. He is having in this case, it's a breakfast with them. He's eating with them again. They are together and sharing this experience. I chose Genesis chapter 18 for the first reading this morning because it was speaking of how Abraham hosted the Lord, who appeared as 3 men to him. Abraham provided a meal for the Lord. Here, the Lord provides a meal for his disciples. And once again, we kind of get this bookending thing, Genesis to John. There's another interesting little stat that comes into this. When Peter is dragging the net that isn't breaking, it's so full of fish, it says 153 of them. And that might make you wonder, okay, 153. That's interesting. What can that mean? Because again, you're not going to waste ink and parchment just because you want to throw in a little bit of trivia. 153, what could this mean? Well, a lot of people have thought about this. And St. Augustine in the 4th century, so the 300 CE, had used a form of numerology to think that maybe what's going on here is this is a representative number of something significant. And he hypothesized that the sum total of the first 17 integers add up to 153, which is true, they do. If you go 1 plus 2 plus 3 plus 4 plus 5 all the way up to 17, you'll get 153. Okay, and well, 17 is 7 plus 10, right? 2 significant numbers. 7, that complete number, you know, 10, 10 commandments, you know, that kind of thing. And Augustine is trying to say that there's some kind of code for that. Okay. Another idea that came around involves something called gematria or gematria. There's a couple of ways to pronounce that word. But what gematria is about is because there are no numerals in Hebrew or in Greek, if you wanted to count, if you wanted to do math, you would simply use the letters of the alphabet and assign a value to each letter in the alphabet. So in Greek, the first letter alpha is 1, beta is 2, gamma is 3, delta is 4, epsilon is 5, and so on and so forth. So The most famous example of gematria is in the book of Revelation, where it talks about the beast whose number is a man's number, and his number shall be 666, right? And so the best gematria number that has come up with that is if you take the title Caesar Nero in Greek, it adds up to 666. Right? So that is the most famous example of this kind of thing. But if this 153 is supposed to be that, what could it possibly be? Well, someone has discovered that if you take the title The Magdalene, it'll add up to that number. What's that all about? Well, Mary Magdalene, first of all, Magdalene is not her last name. Magdalene means she is from Magdala. So we would say it's Mary of Magdala or Mary the Magdalene, just like we would say Jesus of Nazareth or Jesus the Nazarene. So Mary Magdalene is in every one of the resurrection stories. She alone is the one who sees Jesus at the tomb in the Gospel of John. She's a significant person in all of these resurrection appearances. And someone is thinking, well, when you take in Greek the Magdalene and you add up all of those letters, it equals 153. Okay? And that means what? Still don't know. There's a couple other ideas too. 153, it's been surmised that that is how many species of fish it was understood existed in the world at the time. So if they caught 153 fish, it means they caught all the kinds of fish. There's also an idea that there were 153 nations or 153 people groups in the world at the time. So if you're catching 153, you know, because Jesus said you're fishers of fish, you're going to be fishers of men at the beginning of the gospel, then the idea is they caught all the people, maybe. Who knows? We really don't know. I think chances are really good that what has happened is the number 153 had a significance that was commonly known then, but it's lost to us now. Kind of like for those of you who took my Life, the Universe, and Everything class, if I told you that they caught 42 fish, you would go, I see what you did there. And those of you that didn't take the course and haven't read The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy would be at a complete loss as to what on earth I could possibly mean. 42, by the way, is the answer to the question of life, the universe, and everything, in case you're wondering, right? So just saying, you know, that would be it. So I think perhaps something like that has happened. Like imagine 1,000 years from now, someone comes across a recording of this sermon, but there are no copies of The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy left. Nobody could possibly figure out what that 42 would mean without having the source material, right? So maybe something like that has happened. I probably spent more time than I needed to on that particular bit of trivia in this reading. But the point that I'm really trying to get to ultimately here is this, especially if we are allowing ourselves to be the seventh disciple. What we are seeing is the retelling of a couple episodes from the beginning of the Gospels. The miraculous catch of fish from Luke chapter 5. Peter perhaps wanting to make good on successfully walking across the water, perhaps from Matthew chapter 14. The feeding of the 5,000 from Mark 6, Matthew 14, Luke 9, and John 6. These revisiting of these stories, the Last Supper, once again. They're the same and yet different. The nets don't break. When the miraculous catch of fish happened the first time, Peter fell before Jesus and said, "Go away from me, Lord, I am unworthy to be in your presence." But now with the miraculous catch of fish, Peter makes a beeline for Jesus. He can't wait to be there with him. Things are similar, different. Things are repeated and yet not the same. There is something more, there is something new. And I think reading this chapter devotionally, we are encouraged to see ourselves in the story because the story continues. The story didn't end 2,000 years ago. The story continues now. Those who had seen Jesus got to see him again and were with him, but anybody reading this story has not seen Jesus, but who through faith continue to believe, continue to encounter the risen Christ today. Just as in John 14, when Jesus says, "It is good for you for me to go away. If I get out of here, then nobody is going to have to keep on trying to be exactly where I am, because instead, by my Spirit, I will be wherever you are." And we today experience the risen Christ through faith in a way similar to the way his disciples encountered him physically. The story is the same and yet different. The story is something that happened and yet something that continues to happen. Something that was unique at one time and yet revisited with tweaks here and there as we carry on now 2,000 years removed. As we are at this second last sermon to close out the Gospel of John, let me encourage you this morning to think of this story in that way, to think of yourselves clearly as one of Jesus' disciples who today are experiencing the risen Christ through faith, though you have not seen, you believe. And in that experience, continue to share in the life that Peter and the others were able to enjoy, having been with him in person. Amen.